This is the Inland Journal. I'm Doug Nadvornik. Next Sunday morning, we all move our clocks forward an hour, part of the semi-annual spring forward, fall back ritual of moving back and forth between standard and daylight time. Some parts of the country stay with one or the other, and Marcus Riccelli would like Washington to join that group. The Spokane Democratic representative has sponsored a bill to place the Evergreen State permanently into the daylight saving time category. His bill has moved through two committees and is now headed to the floor of the House of Representatives. Riccelli has cited the benefits touted by University of Washington law professor Steve Calandrillo, who has been promoting this idea for a decade or more. Calandrillo is on the phone with us now. So here's what gets me. You're a law professor. What's your interest in daylight savings time? How does that fit into your professional life?
Well, one of the topics that I teach at the University of Washington School of Law is economic analysis of law. And what economic analysis of law is really just the study of how legal rules affect overall social welfare, how legal rules affect behavior, and daylight saving time is one of those legal rules. And in my research, I've discovered that we can save hundreds of lives per year by moving to permanent daylight saving time.
So give me some of your evidence here. I know there's health evidence, there's other evidence. Go ahead and hit me with it.
Sure. Simply put, darkness kills. And darkness is far more deadly in the evening hours than it is in the morning hours. The evening rush hour has roughly twice as many fatalities as the morning rush hour does, mostly because there's more drivers on the road. Everybody's awake and moving around. There's children enjoying outdoor unsupervised play. There's more alcohol in drivers' bloodstream. And you have a dramatic spike in fatal vehicle crashes, both vehicle-on-vehicle and vehicle-on-pedestrian crashes in the evening hours once the sun goes down. And what daylight saving time is about where does sunlight matter more? Does it matter more in the morning at 6:30 in the morning, or does it matter more in the evening, let's say at 5:30 p.m.? And it matters more in the evening. The morning rush hour is, as I said, half as deadly as the evening rush hour is. It tends to be more regimented and more predictable. And so the research that I've seen on traffic fatalities from the Insurance Institute for Highway Safety, from Rutgers researchers Coate and Markowitz, and from Sullivan and Flanagan indicate that we could save between 300 to 400 lives per year by moving to permanent daylight saving time. Again, having more sunlight in the evening hours helps prevent some of those accidents. Now, obviously, you're trading that off with the morning hours, but you don't increase the danger as much in the morning as much as you reduce the danger in the evening. So that, in my opinion, is the best reason for daylight saving time, is saving lives on the road. The second best reason for daylight saving time is that crime would decrease, because darkness is also a friend of crime. Criminals like to do their work in darkness, and they like to do their work in evening darkness. They don't tend to work in morning darkness before sunrise. The crime rates are extremely low at 5 o'clock in the morning, even though it's still dark outside. But when you look at 5 o'clock in the evening, 6 o'clock in the evening, and all through the evening hours, that's where the crime rates start to increase. And so the theory behind daylight savings time reducing crime is you're moving one extra hour of sunlight into the evening portion of the day, taking away an hour from criminals' workday. And so, as I like to say, you know, whatever reason that criminals are late to bed and late to rise, we should take advantage of it by reducing their workday by 1 hour. And I saw a British meta study when I wrote my paper on daylight saving time 10 years ago that estimated that improved street lighting and improved sunlight would have the potential to reduce crime by 20%, especially juvenile crime that peaks in the after school hours.
So you get to the question of, and I know that I asked Marcus Riccelli this question, the question of, do you care if it's daylight savings time or standard time? And he said, yeah, I prefer daylight savings time.
Yes.
And you're the same way?
Yes, we cared tremendously about whether it's permanent standard time versus permanent daylight saving time. Now, keep in mind, the term standard time is a little misleading because 8 months of the year we're on daylight saving time. So The normal is actually daylight saving time. It's only in the 4 months of winter that we move to standard time. And it matters a lot whether we have permanent standard or permanent daylight saving time because, again, it's whether you want more sunlight in the morning hours or you want it in the evening hours. Now, the critics of daylight saving time will say that the clock switch itself is harmful, right? The switch in spring when you lose an hour of sleep, also even the switch in the fall when you gain an extra hour of sleep because it messes up sleep cycles. There's lots of data now that show that there's increased health risks when you do that. that. In fact, heart attacks spiked 24% in the week following the spring clock change. But the solution is not permanent standard time, because if you move to permanent standard time, then you have an extra hour of evening darkness all year round. And that would have the effect of killing many more motorists and pedestrians on the road, and also increasing crime, even though obviously it would save the increased heart attack risk in the week following the March spring forward.
Although Representative Riccelli makes the case that if we wanted to move to standard time, we would, the state of Washington could do that unilaterally, whereas if it wants to move to daylight savings time, it needs an act of Congress, so to speak. Why is that?
That is true. So under the 1966 Uniform Time Act that Congress passed, the goal was to create uniformity among times across the United States. Prior to 1966, different states and even different cities followed different plans for daylight saving time. So they would enact it on different days of the year. You know, the Twin Cities of Minneapolis, Minnesota, and St. Paul, Minnesota had different clock schedules, even though they're located right across a river from each other. And so you might imagine that creates all kinds of confusion, as you know, if you're going to meet somebody at 9 o'clock, which 9 o'clock is it? And so Congress said in 1966, we need to stop this confusion. And they passed the Uniform Time Act, which says that if you want to move to daylight saving time, which 48 states do, you have to do so on the same date each year, and you have to move off of it on the same date each year. And so currently, that's the second Sunday in March that we're going to spring forward, and it's the first Sunday in November that we're going to fall back, and that creates uniformity. But if you don't want to move to daylight saving time, Congress says you don't have to, right? You could stay on standard time all year, like Hawaii does and like Arizona does. And so it is easier, technically, for a state to just switch off daylight saving time. We could switch to permanent standard time. We would not need to get Congress's approval to do so. But I think that would be a tremendous mistake to move to permanent standard time, because obviously that will increase overall fatalities and crime.
So my perception is this has a lot more energy this year as in past years. I know Oregon's been dealing with it. Idaho has taken it up again. Washington's got at least two bills. Is my perception correct? And if so, why this year?
Your perception is correct. There is newfound momentum behind permanent daylight saving time, and it's not just the states you mentioned. California voters also voted 60-40 in favor of permanent daylight saving time. Last year, Florida voters or Florida legislature passed the Sunshine Protection Act, which voted to move the state to permanent daylight saving time. There is definitely newfound evidence, and I think the reason for that is we've started to realize that the biannual clock switch is not good for our health, and so we're better off on a uniform system of time all year round. Now, as I said, I think that system should be permanent daylight saving time, not permanent standard time. But I do think there's a lot of new evidence about the health risks associated with clock switching, about disrupting sleep cycles. And I think that is part of the reason why there's this new momentum. Plus, you have big states like Florida and California talking about it. You know, that spurs momentum in Washington and Oregon and other states across the country.
Well, I think Florida, the governor signed into law last year.
He did. And they and my understanding is that Senator Rubio has two bills pending before the Senate to try to get the Congress to act. Because, again, to move to permanent daylight saving time, Florida will need Congress to give its okay.
So then do you think it's inevitable rather than if or not?
I'm hesitant to say that anything in Congress is inevitable. I certainly think the trend is moving in the right direction. I think most Americans appreciate having more sunlight in the afternoon hours when virtually everybody's awake. You know, correspondingly in the morning hours, obviously it's nice to have sun too, but, you know, half of your population's asleep. And so it's about moving sunlight into the area of the day in which more people can benefit from it. I certainly think the momentum is in the right direction, but I wouldn't call anything inevitable until I see the president sign it.
And even then, well,
that's you never know.
So did I miss anything, Steve?
I think you pretty much covered all the major reasons. In the short article I sent you, I also indicated at the end that both recreational and commercial interests tend to favor daylight saving time. Chambers of commerce, businesses enjoy extra sunlight because people are more willing to go out and shop in sunlight than they are in darkness. Once darkness hits, people tend to just retreat to their homes. And by the way, the other reason we didn't talk much about is the energy savings rationale. And in the old days, that was was the dominant rationale for extending daylight saving time. That's why we invented it in, well, the Germans were the first to implement it, but we copied quickly during World War I to save on gas and oil during the war efforts. Because if you have more sunlight in the evening hours, you can use less electricity, less oil, less gas to heat your home. And correspondingly, in the morning hours, when people are still asleep, they don't need to use as much oil or electricity or gas. That's the traditional rationale. That's the rationale we used in World War I, in World War II. That's the same rationale we used in after the OPEC oil crisis. We did have permanent daylight saving time in 1974 to help us save oil and gas because there was, you know, gas lines and rationing. It saved 150,000 barrels of oil, according to President Nixon. And that, by the way, was also the same rationale when Congress extended the Uniform Time Act in 2007. It used to be that we didn't spring forward until April, and we rolled back in October. And you'll notice that now it's in March and November. And again, the rationale was this will help us save energy. And, you know, the energy savings arguments, I've seen critics of that argument as well, because I think the energy savings are not as dramatic as they used to be. But part of that is because more of our energy costs now go to cooling costs than used to be. It used to be just people heated their homes; they had no air conditioning. With the rise of air conditioning, you won't see as much of an energy savings because obviously daylight saving time makes it harder to cool your home when the sun is out. That's part of the reason, by the way, why Hawaii and Arizona don't do it.
Well, then I'll finish with this one, and maybe you already touched on it. What about the argument that you don't want children standing out in the cold in the dark at 7 o'clock in the morning? What do you think about that one?
Again, I understand the school children argument. You don't want children waiting for the bus in darkness or walking to school in darkness. But either way, you know, a lot of school kids are walking home after practice, after track practice, or after whatever sport they're playing at 4 p.m. right now in the wintertime in darkness. And so, again, there's certainly risk. There would be added risk in the morning. A lot of schools dealt with that in 1974 by moving their school day back 1 hour, which is one way to deal with it, or increasing the amount of busing or crossing guards. And the National Safety Council did a study after the 1974 experiment and found that there was no net increase in danger or no net increase in accidents involving school children. Obviously, there were some added accident risk in the morning, but it was more than offset by the reduced accident risk in the afternoon.
Steve Calandrillo is a supporter of moving Washington to daylight saving time permanently. He's a professor of law at the University of Washington. And now a fascinating discussion about an issue that has split people who practice the Methodist faith. Shall gay Methodists be allowed to serve as clergy in their church, and shall they be allowed to marry? In St. Louis last week, leaders in the church held a special off-year conference to address those issues. At least three options, from a traditional conservative view to more progressive and permissive plans, were put before the members. Today, Tracy Simmons from SpokaneFaves.com, the Spokane Faith and Values newsletter, talks about the conference with one of the leaders of the Methodist Church in Eastern Washington who attended.
My name is Greg Seeley. I'm an ordained pastor in the United Methodist Church. Currently, I'm not serving a local church. I'm what's called the district superintendent. So I supervise the 45 churches in the eastern half of eastern Washington and northern Idaho.
So, Greg, I was wondering if you could give us a little recap of the conference that you just attended.
Yes. So in St. Louis last week, we had the 2019 special called session of General Conference. In the United Methodist Church, a General Conference is the meeting of the whole denomination. And 2019 was an off year, was an odd time to have it. We usually have it every 4 years. Our last one was 2016. Our next regularly scheduled one is 2020. They scheduled a special session to deal with issues around human sexuality and how inclusive we would be with folks. We hope to have some clarity. I think we do have some clarity. It wasn't the clarity that a lot of people hoped for, but that was the main topic, was to come to some clarity.
And the news that made headlines, of course, is that the church voted to maintain a ban on LGBTQ clergy and same-sex marriage. Is that right?
Yes. So there were several plans in front of the conference, and the conference chose by about a 53 to 47% margin, so just a subtle majority, to back what was called the traditional plan that does strengthen language. It does add some things to the definitions of what a quote-unquote self-avowed practicing homosexual person is. That language isn't my favorite, but that's what's in our Book of Discipline. So it defined that further, and it put some other teeth in place. Sometimes people call it gracious accountability. It felt like a punitive measures that were added into that particular plan. There was also one plan passed that's called the disaffiliation plan that would allow churches to leave if they couldn't agree with the denominational stance. It still would require a 2/3 vote of the local church and a 2/3 vote of the annual conference. But so those are the two main things that passed, was this traditional plan and one disaffiliation plan.
The plan that many groups were pushing for was called the One Church Plan.
Yeah, about 2/3 of the U.S. delegates and about 80% of our bishops supported what was called the One Church Plan. The challenge in our denomination right now, it is the nature of our denomination right now, is we're a global denomination. So we have folks, the growing part of our church is in Africa and the Philippines and in the global south. That's the dynamics in our denomination. So even though 2/3 of U.S. delegates supported a different plan, the church as a whole went in this, what I would say, a little bit more conservative direction.
And I understand the traditional plan that was passed also includes a type of punishment for clergy who disobey. Is that correct?
For clergy and for bishops who don't uphold the punishments. So the way it is in our Book of Discipline before this plan passed was punishments are held or adjudicated by the annual conference, by the region that they're in. And bishops, if there's a charge against a bishop not doing what they're supposed to do, it's adjudicated in their jurisdiction. So the Western jurisdiction bishops would take care of charges against a Western jurisdiction bishop. The traditional plan seeks to institute mandatory penalties that are out of the hands of a local conference, and it takes the punishments away from the Western jurisdiction for bishops and creates another committee denomination-wide that would then deliver the punishments to bishops. So that's the teeth or the accountability piece that was kind of added in. The other thing I guess I should say is they asked for a judicial council ruling, which in our polity, the judicial council is kind of like the Supreme Court. They asked for a ruling ahead of time for a lot of these petitions and measures, and the punishments part was deemed unconstitutional, and it wasn't amended before passed. So it's been sent back to the Supreme Court, the judicial council. Most people are assuming that that will be ruled unconstitutional, which means it just is as if it didn't pass. It won't show up in our Book of Discipline. But we don't know for sure. But that's the assumption, I think.
Okay, so there's still a lot of unknowns waiting for the dust to settle.
Dust settling is a great metaphor for kind of where we are in our denomination right now.
And I know you grew up in the Methodist Church, so how are you feeling with all of this right now?
This is a very painful time. The version of the United Methodist Church that passed General Conference is not the United Methodist Church that I was baptized into and grew up in. The part of the reason I'm Methodist is our focus on grace, and this doesn't feel like a very graceful way of being church. And so it is a painful time.
Locally, how's the reaction been? Are people fleeing for the hills or people coming together?
We're still waiting to see. That's a little bit of the dust settling. I know a number of people. So a lot of people who might be more centrist or moderate, as well as folks who are progressive, are surprised that the One Church Plan didn't pass. I think it caught a lot of people off guard. And especially in this part of our conference, so our conference covers the whole state of Washington and the panhandle of Idaho. So you can imagine on the west side of the state, it leans more progressive than this side of the state does, just like our Washington state politics tends to do. So the reaction here, most congregations are probably closer to that 50-50, 60-40. I mean, it's much more diverse theologically than in other parts of our state. That being said, most of our local churches have figured out a way to be church together, even if they don't always agree. And I think that was the hope with the One Church Plan, was that people could be church together and we wouldn't have to have, you know, an outside entity coming in and punishing a congregation or a clergy person exercising their faith out of their conscience. So I would say the majority of folks, even in this district, in this area of our conference, are disappointed that the One Church plan didn't pass and are thinking about, well, what our next steps are. There are some folks in this district and in this area who are pleased that the traditional plan passed. And I'm the supervisor and the district superintendent for all of those folks.
I remember you saying when we talked earlier that the Pacific Northwest or this area has figured out a way to kind of be a safe space for people, and your hope is to kind of extend that safety and be an example to others. Can you kind of explain that further?
Yeah. So our Book of Discipline, even before this general conference, had language in the Book of Discipline saying that same-gender couples should not be married in our churches, clergy should not officiate those services, and that language, self-avowed practicing homosexual persons, shouldn't be ordained or appointed to our churches as pastors. Our conference, as well as all the other conferences in the Western jurisdiction, have really been ignoring those prohibitions and that language, and have grown into this way of being church that says, yeah, that we don't believe that, so we're going to just do it differently. So a lot of my friends are folks who are openly gay folks, people who are in same-gender relationships, and very gifted and called people to be in ministry, and we've recognized those gifts. In this conference, though, that doesn't mean everybody in the conference agrees with that, but as leadership, that's kind of the direction that our conference has taken. I would say in general, and the sense that I had when I was in St. Louis, was we have felt pretty safe in this part of United Methodism world. We felt pretty safe because punishments didn't really happen. We weren't kicked out of ministry. Our bishops, even if they didn't punish people for breaking the official rules of the United Methodist Church, they weren't sanctioned or punished in any way. With these sanctions coming in, the fear is that that could change some things. But without the teeth, which we think are probably unconstitutional, there is a sense that we still feel fairly safe in this part of the world to be Methodist, how we think the Methodist faith should be practiced. But it's not enough for us to just be safe here. I talked to countless people from around, especially around this country, while I was in St. Louis, who are in conferences where they are not safe, where the bishops and or district superintendents will bring down punishments on them if they're known to be openly gay folks or if they officiate a same-gender wedding, some of those kinds of things. So they are not safe, and they could have their credentials taken away. They could be defrocked and all kinds of things. And so I feel a responsibility to extend the safety we feel here in the West and see if there isn't a way to protect our siblings elsewhere in the connection.
That's Greg Seeley from the United Methodist Church in Eastern Washington talking with Tracy Simmons from SpokaneFaves.com. Thank you for joining us for this Inland Journal. To find and subscribe to the daily Inland Journal podcast, search for Inland Journal in iTunes, NPR One, or Google Play, or find it on the Inland Journal page at SpokanePublicRadio.org. And tell us what you think of the program by sending your comments to InlandJournal@kpbx.org. You can leave audio comments on our listener line at 509-232-6904. Thank you for listening. I'm Doug Nadvornik.